their appetites aroused, they were not eager to subside. He bared his teeth in a mirthless grin.
Fall back to the entry points, he said. We need reinforcements.
Almes, Primaris Grade Cardinal World.
Incoming!
Amatnim looked up from his tactical projections.
What?
His skin was still damp from the meditation chamber, and it chafed against his battle plate at the sudden motion. A flare of light filled the command deck as a ship exploded. He dismissed the projections.
Which vessel was that?
He demanded. Another flare of light, and another, and another. The viewscreen seemed to ripple with them, and he could hear the Glory Eternal's subsonic snarl of consternation.
Someone report! Now!
Amatnim bellowed as he rose to his feet.
We're under attack,
a word-bearer said from the Primus Strategium, just behind the command throne. The raised plinth was all but hidden by a constant swarm of tactical data and telemetry feeds. Amatnim turned.
So I gathered. By whom and from where? The asteroid belt. It started as soon as we entered.
Amatnim turned back to the viewscreen. The fleet had entered the asteroid belt, trusting the smaller vessels of the pirates to find relatively safe paths to the planet beyond. Where that wasn't possible, frigates employed their weapons batteries to break up the chunks of debris and open larger pathways for the Glory Eternal and the remaining cruisers. He saw a flash and pointed.
There! Grid point Zeta 26! Magnify!
The image on the viewscreen shimmered and expanded. A squat shape spurted from the greater tumbling mass of stellar debris. Amatnim recognized it as a type of mining vessel. It closed quickly with an assault cutter. There was a staccato flash as an improvised plasma lance scythed out, cutting into the assault craft's hull. The lance flickered again and again, too rapidly for the cutter's crew to react. The larger vessel succumbed, its death throes consuming the smaller. More small vessels slashed into view, their thrusters hurling them forward in fits and starts, a clear sign that they were being pushed past tolerance levels. Some exploded before they reached their targets. Others only managed a single shot before they were ripped apart by the strain of the attempt.
Fire ships,
Amatnim said, not without admiration.
They've converted ore cutters into fire ships.
He turned.
Contact all ships. I want them to target those vessels. Now!
More explosions lit up the viewscreen. Damage estimates rolled across the data feed. Escorts and attack craft burned in the void. The ore cutters were little more than armored torpedoes, built to withstand damage that would crumple any other vessel of comparable size. Worse, they were armed. The lances they wielded were small pinpricks of light, but they stung nonetheless. Amatnim sank back down in his throne. The ore cutters were no threat to the larger vessels in his fleet, but they were a definite hindrance. They impacted against the fleet screeners, scattering them or forcing them to tighten their formations.
Contact the Dark Apostle, he said to the word-bearer at the Vox station. He should have landed by now. When you've established a link, patch it through to my personal frequency.
He turned back to the viewscreen. He watched the pirate vessels, led by Prince Ganor's frigate, spread out ahead of the Glory Eternal and the rest of the fleet. They were eager, impatient. He'd learned much about them since Ganor had joined him. Most of the pirates were just that, criminals and outlaws. But some, like Ganor, were victims of circumstance. The worshippers of the corpse god were harsh with those who proved themselves unwilling to serve their morbid creed. They alienated those who might otherwise have been their staunchest servants. He smiled.
So has it ever been, he murmured.
Ganor served a new master now, though he knew it not. The princeling had a demon in his belly, no less savage than that which inhabited Lacamhew's slave. In time, with the proper attention, it might even grow into something great and terrible. He wondered what would become of Almes under Ganor, and what would become of Ganor if he was made ruler of Almes. Together, they might become something truly pleasing to the gods. But first, the world had to be wrested from its current owners. His vox chimed, interrupting his train of thought.
What do you want?
Lacomhue snarled, his voice distorted by static. Amatnim grinned. Lacomhue sounded stressed.
We are under attack. Ships launched from the mining facilities. Would you mind seeing to it, brother?
Humor, Amatnim?
No, simply a request from one legionary to another.
Silence, broken only by the crackle of static. Soon they would be out of Vox range, unless Lacomhue managed to take the facility. Then...
I will make the attempt.
That is all I ask, brother.
Lacomhue cut the connection. Amatnim sat back, smiling.
All ahead full, he called out. Almes awaits.
Prince Ganor cursed as the command deck of Kabalevsky's Wrath shivered. The frigate shuddered again as its forward batteries unleashed a salvo against another wave of ore cutters. The tiny vessels ceased to exist, but there were more coming. Dozens of them, hiding in the asteroid belt. The damn miners had seemingly weaponized every scow at their disposal. He ground his teeth in frustration. He could only imagine what the word bearers were thinking. Conflicting shouts from his crew warred for his attentions. Ganor turned as Loomis, his first officer, called to him from the Primus Strategium.
My lord! Three more on the starboard side!
Loomis was a spare, hollow-cheeked man, his bald head studded with feed cables that connected him directly to the frigate systems. Loomis had been a devotee of the machine god once. Now he served Ganor.
Can we avoid them?
No, my lord! They're too close! No time to alter course!
Then keep firing, he snarled. Take as many of them out as possible.
Thankfully, there weren't that many ore cutters. He knew enough about the mining facilities to know that there were maybe a few hundred, three at the most. Their plasma lances were little more than pinpricks to the larger vessels of the fleet, but for anything smaller than a frigate, they might spell disaster.
Incoming Vox, my lord!
A crewman called out.
Purge it through,
Ganor said.
If I survive this, I'm taking your head, Ganor,
Amina Deal snarled.
You never said anything about dogfighting miners.
Ganor winced and modulated the frequency volume.
Deal, how nice that you're still alive. We're almost through the asteroid belt. If you'd like to meet on neutral ground...
Deal's response was inarticulate cursing. Ganor swiped two fingers across his throat, and the Vox operator cut the frequency. He sat back. He knew the other captains would be sending him similar messages, blaming him for things entirely outside his control. But they'd see things differently once they reached Almes. His hands curled into fists as he stared at the viewscreen, watching broken asteroids spin past the prow of his ship. Little dots of light marked the presence of outposts and auger stations. Almes knew they were coming by now, whether the Cardinal Governor had admitted it or not. He slumped back in his seat, imagining the homecoming that awaited him, imagining what he would do with a world, a system of his own.
It will be as it was before,
he nodded. It would be like it had been before. That perfect kingdom of childhood memory, when the Kabalevsky name was feared and respected.
All will love you and bow before you.
He smiled slightly and felt something in him purr in satisfaction. Ever since he'd met Amatnim, he'd felt as if he possessed a greater clarity than ever before, as if his desires were within reach. As if all the galaxy were there for the taking.
It is yours. All you have to do is listen. Listen.
He sat back, feeling the reverberations of the guns echoing through the deck plates. Every thud felt like a heartbeat, Every pulse brought him a step closer to his goals. Asteroids cracked and shattered, spinning from the frigate's path. Other vessels closed in and ranged ahead, and a brief, mad urge to fire on them, to claim the vanguard for himself, filled him. Instead, he signaled Loomis.
All ahead, fall! We're close enough to the edge of the belt to burst through!
Is that wise, my lord?
Gannor laughed.
Ha! Probably not.
He rose.
But do it anyway. I've waited too long, endured too much, to let someone else have first sight of what is mine by right. Now, all ahead, fall!
Loomis obeyed. The command flew from one station to the next, and the thrusters fired. The frigate surged ahead, weapons batteries hammering at the debris around it. Gannor stumbled slightly and braced himself on the side of his command throne. More Vox messages came in, but he ignored them all. If they couldn't understand, he didn't have the patience to explain it to them.
I'm coming home, he growled,
his hand falling to the shuriken pistol on his hip. No one was going to stop him. Not this time. Not like all the other times he'd led raids or tried to slip the sensor nets. This time, he had an army at his back. A real army. Not just whatever ships he could scrape together.
Welcome home, Gannor.
And then, the last of the asteroids tumbled past, breaking up, leaving the way ahead clear. Kavalevsky's wrath sailed into the open.
Cease fire!
Gannor said. Loomis relayed the order, and the command deck fell silent. On screen, their destination swelled.
Magnify,
Gannor said. Then, more loudly,
Magnify, damn you! Let me see it!
His crew hastened to obey. The image expanded.
Oh, miss, Gannor breathed. It was even as he remembered. A blue jewel hanging in the firmament. He had been little more than a child when they'd been forced to leave, but it hadn't changed in all that time.
Orders to fall, he said. I want to know what's waiting for us.
On his tactical display, runes denoting orbital defenses flickered into view. Pergo had only had a few dozen, mostly automated torpedo launchers, but Almais was a different beast entirely. Hundreds of defense stations ringed the world, extending from the immense wreath of orbital dockyards. Others drifted independently, their autonomous systems activated by proximity. He heard the blurt of binaric and knew these vanguard posts were asking for identification codes. He turned.
Loomis, introduce us to the bastards, eh?
Aye, Captain,
Loomis growled. Klaxons howled as Loomis barked orders into the Vox. The forward batteries of Kabalevsky's Wrath spat fire, and a defense platform was reduced to spinning wreckage.
Torpedoes! Wide sweep! Target the closest platforms! Let's clear the decks for our allies!
Gannor raised two fingers.
On my mark! Fire!
Chapter 20, 873202, Almais, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. When the first enemy vessel emerged from the asteroid belt, Almais's orbital defenses were waiting. Lance platforms and macro cannon batteries opened fire, splitting the black with streamers of hot light. A frigate died in that opening volley, its hull pierced from a dozen angles. Attack craft burned, reduced to drifting motes. But as more vessels emerged, the orbital defences were less able to concentrate fire. Calder watched it all from the strategium, noting the position of the largest vessels and estimating their targets. It would have been impossible for a human to keep up with the rapid flow of data, but Calder consumed it greedily. Every pick capture, every scan, all of it helped him build a map to victory. Many of the smaller enemy vessels were heading for the slowly trundling refugee vessels. Easy pickings. Calder felt a flicker of sympathy, but quashed it. Their deaths would preoccupy the foe, allowing for the closest defence platforms to properly triangulate their firing patterns. Every man and woman must do their duty for the Emperor, even if that duty was only to die at the appointed time. The Strategium Chamber was strangely silent, despite the crowd of officers, scribes, and ecclesiarchal representatives that occupied it. A squad of intercessors stood arrayed about the foot of the observation dais, bolt rifles held at the ready. Dozens of cyber cherubs flitted this way and that, recording everything, or filling the air with incense.
"They're concentrating on the Western Hemisphere," Calder said out loud.
"On us, you mean?" Eamon stood beside him on the observation dais, watching as his world's defences fell one by one.
He was right. They have no interest in the rest of the planet. Just us.
He sounded exhausted. Calder wondered when he'd last slept.
That is to our advantage.
Eamon looked at him.
I don't see how.
We know what they want. They can't simply obliterate us from orbit. They must come and take it.
Calder brought up a hollow schematic.
I have identified 18 potential landing points within easy distance of an entrance to the Cathedral Palace. Of those 18, 10 have been rendered unsuitable by controlled demolition.
Those parts of the city are still on fire, by the way, Eamon said.
And they will remain so until the battle is done.
Calder indicated another grouping of highlighted areas.
Of the 8 remaining areas, 5 have been prepared by Solaro and Rokan. Concealed weapons emplacements, pressure mines and plasma charges.
They might detect them.
I am counting on it. That leaves 3 potential landing zones.
Calder traced a finger along the schematic, illuminating areas as he spoke.
All 3 provide direct access to the processional way. From there, they will make for the Cardinal's Gate, via the Reliquary Boulevards.
How can you be sure?
Calder looked down at him.
It's what I would do.
He turned back to the schematic.
The quickest way for them to reinforce any assault on the Cardinal's Gate will be to break the Pilgrim's Gate along the Northern Processional. That's the closest major vehicle transit path, and that's where they'll bring up their siege equipment. What about gunships?
Tyre asked. He looked up from his data slates.
If they're coming in like they did at Pergamon, the White Scars will handle those. Any gunships that make it down in one piece won't be in any hurry to take off again. To have any hope of delivering an intact force to the Cathedral Palace, they'll have to come by foot.
If there are enough of them, they'll be able to force their way past any cordon we erect,
Eamon said. Calder nodded.
Thankfully, most of their forces will be occupied in Lowtown.
Eamon grimaced. He knew what that meant.
For how long?
Calder turned away.
Long enough.
He paused.
Siegecraft is about limiting an enemy's options. You force them to choose the least worst option, and then exploit that choice mercilessly. Their resources are limited. They cannot maintain a siege for long. We will force them into a stalemate.
A klaxon sounded. Startled, Eamon turned.
What does that mean?
They've reached the tropopause,
Calder said. On the projection, a ship the colour of a torn scab pierced the upper atmosphere. It was a frigate, or had been. Its prow was surmounted by a massive, leering face, and its flanks consisted of corkscrew towers and barnacle-like weapons batteries. The great face seemed to grimace as the atmospheric sensors struggled to capture its enormity. Ground-to-air flak greeted its arrival, and the grimace became a snarl of fury. More vessels joined the first, long streaks of red marring the horizon. The first strike, when it came, was so sudden that even Calder flinched. Lances of light fell like rain. The atmosphere screamed as cloud cover tore and split. Mountaintops soon followed. Bulwarks of metal and stone that held anti-air batteries vanished into blackened craters, leaving nothing behind but fused glass and burning forests. Sensor feeds went black one by one. Soon, they would be isolated from the rest of the world. If there was a pattern to the strikes, Calder could not see it. Some of them were clearly positioned to eliminate flak batteries, but others seemed to be simply for destruction's sake. A map of Almay spun slowly, red dots marking impact points. The number doubled, tripled. The first shockwave reached the city a moment later. The stained glass windows flexed in their reinforced frames. With the second shockwave, they shattered. Multicoloured shards scattered across the chamber, and he heard shouts of pain. He turned, sheltering Aemon as more rained down. The Cardinal Governor was praying, his eyes closed. Sirens echoed up from the city, the sound scrabbling through the windows. Picked feeds displayed emergency crews and enforcers moving to cordon off areas where the shockwaves had done more than break windows. Calder checked the positions of his warriors as he swept glass from his armor, making sure that all of them were where they should be. Another blast shook the cathedral palace to its core, and cracks formed in the walls.
"They'll be finished soon,"
Tyre said as he climbed the dais. He plucked a shard of glass from his cheek.
"They're just softening us up so they can land troops." "Yes,"
Calder activated his vox.
"Torag, it is time,"
the White Scar growled immediately.
"Yes, good hunting, brother."
A moment's pause, then,
"And to you, son of Dawn."
Calder cut the link and looked at Aemon.
"You should get to the command bunker. Tyre will oversee transfer of the primary strategium functions."
He looked around.
"This chamber is no longer defensible."
"What about you?" Aemon asked.
"I will be overseeing the defense of the Cardinal's Gate personally."
He descended the dais and accepted his bolt rifle from one of the intercessors waiting there.
"I will remain in contact with Tyre and the planet's command structure for as long as possible. In the event that I am no longer able to oversee the defense, the Swordmaster will be in overall command."
He looked back at Tyre, who nodded. Ordinarily, Calder would have left one of his own subordinates in charge, but efficiency was not the only consideration in this matter. Politics, as ever, played their part. In any case, Tyre's knowledge of the planetary defenses was second only to his own, and he was confident the Swordmaster could handle the responsibility.
"May the God Emperor be with you, Lieutenant," Aemon said.
Calder paused, then he nodded.
"May he be with us all, Cardinal Governor."
Almace, Primus Asteroid Facilities. Spyros moved quickly along the plasma conduits, quietly, the way he'd been trained to do, almost 2 centuries ago. It was no easy thing to move silently in power armor, even with noise bafflers activated. It required a different way of thinking, an attention to one's surroundings that most space marines weren't interested in. The warriors of the Adeptus Astartes were terror weapons first and foremost. Sound and fury manifest. But there were different types of terror. Below the Raven Guard, the transit corridor was full of bodies. Cultists, renegades, mortals. Easy meat. 30 of them. They moved slowly, looking every way but up. They paused at an intersection, murmuring. The leaders were obvious. They were the ones that looked like they knew what they were doing. Former soldiers, these, at least going by their uniforms. He knew the regiment, though they defaced their equipment. He wondered if they'd been taken captive, given the choice between servitude or death. It didn't matter. The reasons for the treachery were irrelevant. All that mattered was the treachery itself.
"My lord!" "What is it, human?"
Spyros asked, not without some annoyance. He recognized the voice, but couldn't immediately recall the speaker's name. Giving the miners access to their encrypted vox frequency had been a mistake. He told Karras so at the time, but the lieutenant rarely listened to him.
"We are in position, as you requested."
Kulch. That was it. A blunt-faced ore dredger that Reyes claimed was her second in command. He was unimaginative, but dogged in following orders. Tolerable for a mortal.
"As I ordered, yes.
meet me at the next access corridor. We need to hold them here.
He cut the frequency before Kulch could reply. He studied the mortals below, considering. Then he drew his knife and quickly punctured the conduit in three places. His battleplate issued an internal warning chime as the temperature increased. He was already moving as the air of the corridor began to ripple from the plasma leak. The men below would notice, not in time. Every few hundred yards, he stopped to repeat the action. Three blows, no more, no less. Just enough to rupture the conduit, but not enough to cause it to explode. Not right away, at any rate. Eventually, but not yet. When he reached the end of the corridor, he slid quickly to the floor. The cultists were behind him, around the bend in the intersection. The transit corridor was wide and full of machinery, plenty of cover. They were in no hurry to advance. He moved to the bulkhead, leading to the access corridor. His auto-sensors detected warm bodies, and he knew Kulch and the others were waiting. Auto-guns rose as he stepped into view.
"Lower your weapons, fools," he said.
"It is just me."
Kulch stepped forward, mopping at his sweaty features.
"We here, Lord."
"I have eyes, Kulch."
Spyros made a quick head count.
"I only see 10 of you. Where are the others?"
I thought it best to leave them at the last bulkhead. They can cover us, just in case we have to retreat, which we won't, of course, my lord."
Kulch sketched an over-enthusiastic bow.
"Unless you want us to."
Spyro shook his head.
"Stop talking, it irks me."
He tapped a control rune on his vambrace, activating a hollow schematic of this part of the facility.
"Here, there are 4 access hatches along this corridor." "We know them," Kulch said.
Spyros grunted.
"Then you know that they will give you an unrestricted field of fire into the corridor itself, split up into fire teams. You know this term?"
He paused until several of the miners nodded.
"Split up and take the hatches. Keep them pinned, but do not let them rush the hatches. We want them to call for reinforcements. You understand?"
Kulch nodded and then shook his head.
No, but we'll trust in your wisdom, my lord."
The other miners murmured agreement. Spyros sighed.
"When I give the word, seal the hatches and retreat to the rendezvous point."
He paused. Then, because they were who they were, he added,
"Do not tarry." "Why?" Kulch asked.
Spyros looked at him.
"Because the plasma conduit is going to overload and you will perish. And because I have given you an order."
Kulch didn't ask any more questions, nor did any of the others. They spread out as Spyros had ordered. He tracked them on his armor's auspecs, watching as they flanked the enemy. The word-bearer's slaves lacked knowledge of the facility, and if their masters had any, they weren't sharing it. The traitor's strategy was simple. Flood the facility with bodies, but they would run out soon enough. When he was satisfied that Kulch and the others were in position, he extracted a picta-bead from his combat belt. The bead would feed images directly to his helmet display. With a twitch of his wrist, he sent it rolling around the corner, towards the gathered cultists. As it rolled, it scanned its surroundings and fed him data. He took in their positions as he released the mag clamp on his bolt gun and lifted it from where it hung on his thigh. Quickly, he stepped around the corridor and paused long enough for them to see him. His first shot punctured a pressure valve, filling the corridor with obscuring steam. His second and third shot killed the leaders he'd identified earlier. That left the others in a state of panic. They wouldn't retreat. If they fled, their masters would kill them. That meant they had to call for help. Reinforcements. Spyros settled in to wait. Every few moments, he would fire off another shot to keep them interested. In between, Kulch and the other miners did the same. And the plasma continued to leak, filling the air, warping the breached conduit out of shape. When it finally exploded, it would fill the corridor, vaporizing everything not wearing power armor. Darren and the others would be preparing similar ambushes throughout the main facility, or helping the miners to do so. The farther and deeper they drew the enemy from their entry points, the easier it would be to isolate them and cut them off.
Spyros, status.
Karros. Spyros lowered his weapon.
Transit corridor Delta Epsilon 6, third level, initiating plasma purge. Acknowledged. Be advised, reinforcements are on the way.
Ha! Good! More of them to kill.
Fall back to designated rendezvous point, Acrius Oslo, once you're done.
Spyros frowned. That wasn't the plan.
Are we pulling back?
For the moment.
Acknowledged.
Spyros blink-activated the pictofeed. From its position, he could see that the cultists were firing into the spreading steam, attempting to prevent an assault that wasn't coming. He heard the thump of heavy boots and realized that the reinforcements weren't mortal. He grinned fiercely, pleased.
Ha! Kutch! Fall back!
No reply. He heard the roar of autoguns, screams. The feed from the Pictobead went dark as something heavy trod on it. The vox crackled with a babble of voices. He stepped into the open, bolt gun at the ready. Targets sprang towards him, and he fired, putting them down. Kulch was screaming in his ear. The ambushers had been ambushed. Something thudded out of the steam, massive and twisted. It bellowed savagely, the blade it clutched in its talons gleaming with an ugly radiance. Spyros threw himself to the side as the blade tore a chunk from the wall. He rolled to his feet, bolt gun roaring. The blade came down again, quicker than thought, and his weapon was torn from his grip, along with several of his fingers. Spyros cursed and clawed for his combat blade. A claw caught him by the throat and drove him back against the wall. A beatific mask leered out of the steam. He thrust his blade up awkwardly and felt it bite into something that might once have been flesh. Boiling ichor spurted, burning through the seals of his gauntlet. A gurgle of bestial laughter was the creature's only reaction. It dragged him forward and slammed him back, hard enough to daze him. His half-melted blade slipped from his grasp as the thing tightened its grip on his throat. His armor cracked, and he felt his bones do the same.
Be gentle with him.
The voice was harsh, inhuman. A bulky shape stepped into view. Spyros recognized the enemy commander. The traitor's tattooed features split in a ghastly smile.
I need him in one piece.
Almace, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. The hunt was all. Torag sang softly to himself as his Storm Talon banked, assault cannons painting the sky in the colours of death. He hunted the enemy through fields of fire, stalking them with a persistence that he'd been told reminded his brothers of the Burkut, the hunting eagle. Torag found the comparison flattering, if a bit obvious. He flew, so he was an eagle. The gunship was not an eagle, but a hare. It was called Red Hare, after the beast of legend. Its machine spirit murmured softly, pleased to be stretching its engines. It enjoyed the hunt as much as he. More, perhaps. Together, they had hunted on many worlds, through many skies. Skies thick with toxic clouds, and through floating forests of airborne algae. Skies full of hungry predators, and always he had been successful. Always he had proven the superior hunter to his foes. This time would be no different. With the orbital strikes concluded, the enemy had begun to land troops on the surface. Dropships and troop carriers of all patterns and sizes fell slowly through the burning atmosphere, making for the few landing zones left to them. Torag and his hunters had been tasked with clipping the wings of as many of them as possible. Below them, the city cried out in anger. It lashed out at the invaders, tearing at the sky. Streamers of anti-aircraft fire followed him upwards, punching targets from the air. He stroked the controls, and the Storm Talon rolled gently aside as a broken hulk plummeted groundwards, its ruptured hull venting smoke. He caught the thermals of its passing and rode them upwards, letting his assault cannons herald his coming.
Easy meat,
he muttered. Dropships fired at him, but their guns were bulky and slow, meant for clearing landing zones rather than trading fire with aerial opponents. Red hair rolled, thrusters burning. He tapped the trigger rune. His display showed his fellow hunters, above and below him, spreading out around him like the wings of an eagle. A traditional formation, once used by the nomadic horsemen of Chogoris, now employed by their descendants. Sometimes he wondered what they would think of their sons now, those wild riders. Would their hearts swell with pride as they saw what the Khan of Khans had made of them? Or would they shake their heads in dismay at all the traditions left trampled in the dust? Maybe both. He took the Storm Talon up, angling the thrusters to carry him high. Hull-mounted missile launchers twitched, unleashing a salvo. The missiles streaked through the air, impacting multiple targets. He didn't have to destroy them. Wounding them was enough, slowing their descent so that the flak towers could catch them, or causing them to lose control, was almost as clean a kill as eliminating them himself. The kill counter on his display ticked over regardless.
8 so far, he said out loud.
His vox crackled with the voices of his fellow hunters as they replied with their own counts.
3
6 7
4
2 Godshin, 2 of those you claim are mine.
Ha! These skies are full of prey, Yakut. Why seek to claim mine?
Fair is fair, brother. With the 2, I have 8.
Torag grinned.
Ha! Trying to best me, Yakut? I but strive to follow your example, Aquilian.
Ha! Strive harder,
Torag said with a laugh.
I just caught my 9th while you were talking.
He leaned back in his control cradle as Red Hair's engines hummed, carrying him farther and faster. The stars were almost close enough to touch, or so it seemed.
Still too many, Yakut replied, and us too few to get them all. You're right, Yakut. Let us return to base. Leave them to it. I was merely pointing out.
I do not care. You are a hunter, so hunt.
Torag thumbed an activation rune and stitched the hull of a dropcraft with an autogun burst. The flimsy vessel caught fire, and its descent became uncoordinated. As it broke apart, tiny figures slipped from it, spinning upwards as gravity played its cruel games. He grinned in pleasure at the sight, imagining their screams. It was more than they deserved. But Yakut was right. More dropships pierced the tattered atmosphere, almost too many to count. And not just dropships, but gunships as well.
Forget the dropships, he said, alerting the others to the new arrivals. I have sighted worthier prey. Yakut, Godshin, on me! Good hunting, brothers!
The gunships were of an unfamiliar pattern. Old things, sleek and alien-looking. In comparison, Red Hair was a box. But boxes were sturdy things, often containing surprises. Torag's smile widened. Rukan had been right. Why prowl the stars when the enemy would come to them? If they survived, he might even consider apologizing to the old wolf. Chapter 21 90-00-24 Almace, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. Imatnim stood amid the hololithic displays, watching as runes representing the troop landers flickered and blinked out.
How many?
Apis asked, from the other side of the Primus Strategium plinth. Just over half, Imatnim said, as he rotated one of the cartographic images. Well within the parameters for expected casualties. 2/3 of the host's troop landers had converged on Almacia, with the remaining third spreading out to handle the other cities. The surviving pirate vessels were launching their own raids against the latter with a variety of atmospheric attack craft. Pick feeds from the surface showed hundreds of repurposed infantry assault vehicles, some dating from before the heresy, rumbling across the rocky ground away from the surviving landers. The vehicles were daubed crimson and marked with ruinous sigils and totems. Voxcasters mounted on the hulls blared atonal hymns, Inside, the mortal followers of the primordial truth bowed their heads in prayer, or checked their weapons. Their orders were to silence the anti-aircraft batteries located in the hills and crags before descending on Almacia. A simple enough task, given that most of the batteries were automated. The enemy would not waste resources defending them. Another stream of images showed the landing bays of the Glory Eternal, and the remaining gunships being readied for launch. When the battle barge had reached optimal orbit and enough of the anti-aircraft batteries had been silenced, the gunships would pierce the atmosphere and head for Almacia. Over half of the word-bearers under his command would be making the launch, and they would not be alone. Apis studied the projections, his brow furrowed.
"Something disturbs you, brother," Amatnim said.
"Why bother landing troops at all, my lord?" Apis asked. "We have attack craft. Why not simply strike the enemy's heart?"
"We will, but only when we are certain of the blow. First, we must soften the city's defences. That is where the pirates come in. Their holds are packed with the faithful, and they ferry them to their just reward. They will serve to ease our path in their own unique fashion.
The cultists and diabolists would open the way for the Neverborn, spilling blood and reciting the appropriate chants. By the time Amatnim and his brothers arrived, demons would haunt the streets of Almacia, making it a more conducive sort of battlefield.
"I dislike leaving so much to lesser warriors,"
Apis looked up as the lumens of the chamber flickered. Distant klaxons whined as the Glory Eternal met the enemy in the void above Almace. Assault craft from the dockyards swarmed the battle barge like flies and were swatted aside as easily. Amatnim paid the fluctuations no mind.
"Better to risk their lives than ours."
"True, my lord,"
Apis joined him in studying the data.
"Even so, many of us will meet the gods face to face in the coming hours."
"And so, what more could we desire than that moment of perfect clarity? We were bred to die in service to a holy cause, brother. The cause may have changed, but our ultimate purpose has not."
Amatnim looked at the other word-bearer.
"Now go. Get your war dogs ready. I would launch within the hour."
Apis crossed his fists over his chest and bowed his head.
"Gloria Aeterna, my lord."
"Gloria Aeterna, brother."
Almace, Primus Asteroid Facilities. Lacomhue reached into the dying man's chest and removed his heart as easily as he might have plucked apart a piece of fruit. He held the red mass aloft, letting the blood stain his forearm and face before tossing it into the brazier with the rest.
"The hearts of 100 brave men," he murmured.
Symbolically, at least, there was no way to tell if they had been truly brave or not. It was hard to judge with mortals. He watched as a pair of slaves dragged the body of the makeshift altar, adding it to the pile of dead flesh nearby.
"What is courage, and what is merely chemicals?"
he said out loud. His voice echoed through the chamber. It was, or had been, an ore processing centre. Great conveyor belts ran along reinforced plinths, leading to heavy sorting equipment and other, less familiar machinery. Servitors continued to work in the background, despite the presence of Lacomhue and his warriors. The automata had little concern for anything outside of their labours. Mist issued from the plasma vents in the walls, making the air reek of burnt rubber. Lumens flashed silent warnings about flow leakage or jams in the conveyor system. Lacomhue had disabled the klaxons in the chamber, irritated by their wailing. Keeping the facility in one piece wasn't his concern. Taking it from the enemy was. He turned to his prisoner. The Raven Guard hung from the ceiling in a web of chains, his broken limbs splayed and his blood pooling into the wide, sacrificial bowl set below him on the gantry. Lacomhue's blade slave crouched nearby, leaning against its sword. The Space Marine glared down at him through a mask of blood and bruises. Lacomhue gestured with his bloody hand.
"That is one of the eternal questions, of course. Such enigmas are the rocks of our faith. Is it courage or cowardice to serve the gods? Do we have a choice, or are we merely walking well-trodden paths? Opinions?
The Raven Guard spat. Lackamhew smiled.
As expected. Your kind have never been ones to ask the great questions. Or any questions, really. You know neither doubt nor fear. You lack the capacity for philosophical debate. I am sure your masters consider it a fair trade-off. But it is a shame.
He turned.
Bring the others forward.
Word-bearers shoved a coterie of mortals towards the Dark Apostle. The miners were bloody and beaten. They cowered like whipped curs, and Lackamhew's smile widened as he took in the scent of their fear. After a moment's indulgence, he gestured. One by one, their throats were slit, and their blood emptied into a waiting trough. More troughs, once intended as ore sluices, had been dragged forward to create a makeshift circle of significant proportions. At each, a handful of captives waited, men and women, old and young alike. The miners were a fecund lot, and they bred like vermin. Despite the defenders' best efforts, Lackamhew's warriors had taken dozens of prisoners. After the shock of the initial ambush, the word-bearers had grown more careful. Old strategies had been recalled, old tactics employed. Lackamhew had been but an aspirant the day Lorgar had sealed himself away. The heresy was not even a memory to him, but to some of the others, it was still a fresh pain. They remembered the 500 worlds and the campaigns in the dark, and they knew the enemy.
They say your genesire still hunts somewhere in the eye,
Lackamhew said, looking up at his captive.
The eternal shadow cast by the light of the Astronomicon. The wages of our glorious sins. I myself do not believe it, but that is what they say.
The Raven Guard didn't answer, didn't even react. They were depressingly stoic, these milkbloods. Lackamhew sighed and turned to watch as more prisoners were slaughtered, and their blood added to the trough. It wasn't enough yet, but soon. He needed reinforcements, but not mortal ones. He also needed them to last longer than it took for blood to dry, long enough to enforce his claim on the object of this crusade. That required a bit more effort than the usual bit of spilled blood and chanting. Most Diabolists were content to call up the Neverborn, only for the time it took to win a battle. But Lackamhew knew ways to chain them to existence for longer than that. Erebus himself had shown Lackamhew the art of opening an unhealing wound in the skin of reality. It required several days of blood and meat, and something more. A sacrifice, not just of a life, but of lives not yet lived. Of potential. He looked at the blood congealing on his gauntlet, and then up at the Raven Guard.
My brother sent me here to die, you know. He must have known you would be here, so he dispatched me, hoping I would be too preoccupied to prevent him from accomplishing his own task. But instead, I will turn his cunning against him.
He laughed.
And you will help me do it.
Almace, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. For what felt like the first time in a lifetime, Prince Ganor Kabalevsky set foot on the soil of Almace. What should have been a great moment, a moment of celebration, the streets filled with thronging masses of jubilant citizens, was tainted by clouds of smoke and burning vehicles. The assault cutter rested on its landing gear, autocannon swiveling to cover the immediate area. They'd landed in what had once been an ornamental garden. The burning skeletons of fruit trees crackled softly in the wind. The blackened grasses were littered with dead birds. The air had been drawn from their tiny lungs in the vortex of the cutter's landing. Ganor stooped and picked one up.
"This isn't how I imagined it," he murmured.
He let the bird fall and turned back to the cutter. The hull was pitted from anti-aircraft fire, and he could smell oil leaking into the soil of the ravaged garden. It wasn't likely she'd make it back into the air in one piece, but that was a problem for later, and for someone else. He was here now, and he didn't intend to leave. It had taken every trick his pilots knew to get them down in one piece. Others hadn't been so lucky. From her last Vox barrage, Deal's cutters had gone down somewhere in Lowtown, well off target, which was a blessing in disguise, really. Otherwise, he'd have had to kill her, and that might have tarnished his triumph. Not that it was much of a triumph at the moment. He went to the edge of the garden, where some few trees still flowered against a wall of imported marble, and looked out over the city falling away below. A grey spiral of structures, stretching to a horizon now choked with smoke. The city was larger than he remembered. Maybe it had grown in his time away. It would grow larger still, once he'd assumed his rightful place. Though the Kabalevsky clan had never been in the line of succession, he suspected such things no longer mattered. This was the beginning of a new era, or the end of an old one. The Imperium was coming apart at the seams. A blind man could see it. Amatnim had only confirmed it. The old ways were dying, one by one. New ways, new kings, were needed. He winced and rubbed his stomach, nausea from the rapid descent. Maybe nerves. Or maybe something else. The thought frightened him. He'd seen things in his exile that scared him. Men and women warped by Gellipox, diseases that seeped from the walls of salvaged ships, great shapes sliding between the distant stars. But what he'd seen aboard a Matnim's flagship, and yet, somehow, maybe it had not seemed so awful as all that. Maybe his ambition had overridden his fear. Maybe it had poisoned his brain, as Deal claimed. He shook his head. It didn't matter. He was here now. The city, the world, would be his soon enough. He wasn't so foolish as to think he could trust a Matnim, but something told him he was meant to be in this place at this moment. He remembered something his mother had often said, in her rare moments of lucidity. Every man was a story, but not every story was the same. He'd never really understood what she'd meant by that, until now. A Matnim's story was coming to an end, but the story of Prince Ganor was just beginning.
Yeah, it will be a grand story indeed. Prince Ganor.
He turned to watch as the slaves of the Wordbearers spilled down the boarding ramps, chanting hymns and ringing great tocsins. He stepped back as they spilled through the garden in their hundreds. Some wore filthy robes, others gemstone-studded armour. There were women as well as men, all armed, though some carried only the most primitive of weapons.
"Cultists!" a voice rumbled.
Ganor turned. A man stood nearby, watching from the shade of one of the few unburnt trees. He was a soldier, or he had been at some point, before he'd thrown in his lot with new masters. His uniform had been dyed crimson, and his carapace armour was stained with ash and char. Sigils and runes had been carved into the flat panes with an inexpert hand. Looking at them, Ganor felt a twinge of pain at the base of his skull. His eyes slid away.
"Just cultists," the soldier said. "Don't pay them any mind."
He hefted his las rifle and joined Ganor unbidden. He had a bit of fruit plucked from the tree in hand. He proffered a piece, and Ganor took it. It wasn't as succulent as he remembered, nor as sweet. He chewed without joy.
"It's always the way,"
the soldier went on, fruit juices staining his mouth and unshaven chin.
"They send in the sacrificial meat first, and a few of us to give them spine."
He slapped the length of his las rifle.
"But always the meat first."
He chewed noisily.
"Say it sanctifies the ground, makes it so they can walk on it without offending the gods.
You worship their gods?
It was a stupid question, given the man's uniform. The soldier shrugged.
Got to worship something.
His flat gaze took in the cultists as they forced the wrought iron gates of the garden, using the broken remnants of a marble bench as a battering ram. Ganor saw other soldiers, clad similarly to his companion, marching down the boarding ramps, dragging heavy equipment behind them.
It's like a fire, the soldier said. That's what I've decided.
What?
This. All of it. It's a fire.
He ate another piece of fruit, chewing wetly.
It's going to burn the galaxy clean, so that we can start over.
Ganor stared at him. The soldier grinned, and Ganor thought something was moving behind the man's eyes. He looked away quickly. He felt sick.
If we all burn, who's left to start over?
The soldier chuckled and shrugged.
That's for the gods to say.
He dropped what was left of the fruit to the grass and wiped his mouth.
I'm just a spark in the fire.
He looked at Ganor and winked.
And now, so are you.
Ganor considered shooting him as he strode towards the other soldiers, assembling before the cutter, but he resisted the impulse. He turned back to the tree, suddenly hungry for another taste of fruit. But at some point, the fire had spread. So instead, he watched the garden burn. Chapter 22. 93, 30, 30. Almace, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. Lowtown had been hammered flat. Fire had fallen from the sky as troop barges and gunships cleared landing zones. Pirate skiffs had joined the fun, less for strategic reasons than the pleasure of simple destruction. Now the occupants of those vessels hunted the ruins they'd made, rounding up survivors and plundering at will. And they, in their turn, were hunted. Rucken moved silently through the industrial jungle, his scouts padding in his wake. And spread out around them, the dredges of Lowtown scuttled through the forest of girders and conduits. The mortals moved with commendable silence for their sort, though to Rucken's discerning ears they were too loud. They were criminals, mostly, clad in battered or stolen combat rigs and flak armour, carrying a variety of weapons. Autoguns, slug throwers, las carbines, and a few things that even Rucken didn't recognise. Like the White Scars, they showed their affiliations openly, tattoos and gang brands on their flesh, clan colours and sigils on their clothing. They stank of industrial grime, of processed ore and sour metal. Their paws sweated narcotics, but they were hunters born, and had proved it more than once since the enemy had flooded the cramped streets of Lowtown. Knives in the dark, garrots, muffled stump pistol shots and monofilament nooses, all had been put to good use. The mortal slaves of the foe died in droves, barely aware of what had killed them. Rucken had led his motley huntsmen through the slums and drainage tunnels. They had set traps and cut fuel lines. They had even poisoned a water filtration system, killing almost 100 cultists. It was satisfying work, this. The enemy were preoccupied with reaching the Cathedral Palace and paid little attention to the shadow war being waged around them. Then, that was often the way. Though he would never voice such thoughts openly, Rucken saw many similarities between the traitors and their loyalist opposites. Both were often blind to anything not related to the battle at hand. For them, there was only war, an incessant drumbeat guiding them and lulling them. A sad thing, when there was so much else to see. Rucken stopped as the wind turned, bringing with it the smell of unguents and incense. He gestured, and his scouts dropped prone, slithering into whatever cover was available. The gangers did the same, save for the one named Belloc, who crawled forward to join Rucken. The man was bald, and his eyes were hidden behind welder's lenses. He wore battered fatigues beneath a threadbare silk jacket, studded with good luck charms, and held a heavily modified combat shotgun close to his barrel chest.
"What is it?"
he grunted. Rucken tapped his nose.
Smell that?
Belloc sniffed and spat.
Close in, quiet or loud. Depends. Come.
Rucken began to creep forward. Belloc slung his shotgun across his back and followed, though more slowly. They moved past the walls of ruptured hab units and through curtains of torn wiring and moisture netting, following the scent. The trail led them to what had once been a market square. Rubble had been cleared away by labour gangs, and something that might have been an altar erected at the centre of the square. A crowd occupied the space, many of them clad in tattered robes and battered flak armour. Others were naked, save for the filth that smeared their forms. Men and women were dragged, screaming through the crowd, their hands bound, their faces bloody and bruised. The crowd bayed and struck at them as they passed on their way to the makeshift altar, where a tall figure, in the filthy remnants of once rich robes and a moon-shaped, grinning mask, stood waiting. Moonface raised a sickle-shaped blade and beckoned the prisoners on. Their captors hauled them forwards. Belloc fired. Moonface, the high priest, toppled back across the makeshift altar. Rucken looked at the ganger.
Probably not wise, he said.
Belloc replied with an obscenity and rose to his feet. As he did so, Rucken heard a hum, as of many tiny wings. Flies boiled up out of the crowd as they turned towards Rucken and Belloc. The flies surged and swarmed about them, biting and stinging. Rucken bellowed in fury and slashed out with his tulwar, trying to break up the swarm. He saw Belloc fire again and again, pumping shots into the clamouring ranks of cultists. Despite the buzzing in his ears, he heard the thump of bolt pistols and autoguns as his scouts and the gangers opened up from their positions of concealment. The square was soon awash in blood as cultists fell twitching. But the rest continued to chant and clang their tocsins, even as they fired back at the surrounding buildings. Belloc advanced into their ranks, his men following him. On the lumpen altar, the high priest's body had begun to twitch and jerk, as if he might rise up despite his lack of a head. The droning chant reached a febrile pitch, and the air felt greasy and foul. Rucken tasted something bitter on his tongue and turned towards the altar, a warning on his lips, but too late. The high priest's body burst open, and a long, gangling arm covered in mottled flesh reached up from within. The arm fell with a splat, and a horned head appeared, forcing its way up through the dead man's belly. A face like a squeezed pustule with one urine-coloured eye gazed about as the demon forced its narrow shoulders through the dead man's ribcage. When it braced a knobbly foot on the altar, it dragged a rust-eaten blade from the body, with